Overnight in Winona.
Is that what Bob said? See, he always hosts that, doesn't he?
Well, and that's much better than... The Senate Committee on Higher Ed will be in order. I think we're going to take a few minutes today, first of all, to introduce staff, and then just take a minute to introduce all of the senators. But we're going to have an overview on the Office of Higher Ed. But I'd like to welcome everybody, and, you know, I want a lot of input on the committee. Obviously, we've got, you know, a challenge in front of us with the budget deficit, and I know that we all have the best wishes of higher ed in mind and the state, and want to make sure that things are done so that we can continue to function and have the quality of education that we'd like to in the state of Minnesota. So I'll be more than happy to take all the input if you want to, you know, talk up in committee, speak up in committee, or meet with me at any time you want to in the office, and we can discuss it. But I truly do want input from everybody so that we are able to get through the session with a good bill and lots of consensus. First of all, I will introduce, well, I'm Michelle Fischbach. I think most everybody knows, maybe some of the people in the audience don't, but I'm Michelle Fischbach. I'm the chair of the committee. I'm from Senate District 14. I have a committee administrator, Jason Fossum. My CLA, I guess is your official title, is Brooke Listig. Listig. I can't pronounce that yet. I just call her Brooke. And then if you get over there, if the researchers would like to introduce themselves real quickly, that would be helpful.
Sure. My name is Sarah Edlund. I am from Senate Republican Research.
Maya Wife, and I'm committee researcher, fiscal analyst.
Daniel Hicks, DFL Research.
And then I've got an intern from St. John's over there, Andrew Curley, and the committee page, Katie Carbo. I'm sorry. I met her this morning. So, and then I will start over here, and I'll just introduce Jeremy Miller as the vice chair.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Miller, representing Senate District 31. Which includes Houston, Winona, and Fillmore counties. It's the southeastern corner of the state. My family's in the scrap and recycling business in Winona. Dates back to 1910. My two brothers and I are the fourth generation. I take care of all the accounting and finance for our business, along with buying and selling commodities and dealing with new customers. My Senate district includes two Minscu institutions, Winona State University and Minnesota State College Southeast Technical, and I also have one private university in St. Mary's University. We have a very difficult session ahead of us. There's no secrets there. We have a challenging $6.2 billion budget deficit that we have to balance. The legislature is going to have to work very hard and work together with Governor Dayton and our constituents to make some very difficult decisions. The good news is that along with these challenges, there's also a lot of opportunity, and I look forward to working together with everyone on this committee and in the legislature to take advantage of that opportunity. When it comes to higher education, we're very fortunate to have high-quality education at an affordable price here in the state of Minnesota. With that said, I do have some concerns with the amount of money that some of the members of administration get at the University of Minnesota and at the Minscu Central Office. My goal for this committee is to work together with our colleges and universities in the state of Minnesota to continue to provide our students a high-quality education at an affordable price. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Senchum.
You take that long on my Snapchat.
I need to get my notes. Dave Senchum, Rochester, representing Dodge and Olmsted counties. Been in the Senate for 8 years. I do have within my district, or close to it at least, Rochester Vocational Technical College. Winona State houses in Rochester. Actually, they have 6,000 students there, and a 400-member per student University of Minnesota site.
Senator Thomasoni.
David Thomasoni. I'm in my, starting my 11th year in the Senate, my 19th year in the legislature. We have the Northeastern Higher Education District in my district, and UMD is on one side, and Bemidji is on the other side, the four-year colleges. We're in the process of developing a four-year engineering school and a two-year engineering school in conjunction with Mankato State and UMD, and look forward to serving on the Higher Ed Committee. And I'm from Chisholm.
Thank you.
Joe Gimsey. I serve Senate District 13, which is all of Kandiyohi County, Cope County, and the western third of Stearns County. Thank you, Claire. Appreciate that. In my district, I have Ridgewater College, and just to the north and west of me is the University of Morris. St. Cloud State is in a neighboring district. A lot of higher ed. Hutchinson Vocational School is also affiliated with Ridgewater College in my district, and I also look forward to this new experience of serving on higher ed.
I'm John Carlson from Senate District 4. That is the North Central Corridor. 371 is sort of the midline of that. It runs from Pequot Lakes up to Cass Lake, and then it's bordered on the west by Bemidji and on the east by Deer River. In my district, we have Bemidji State University, Go Beavers, newest member of the WCHA, and Central Lakes College is just outside the district, although many of the residents in Senate District 4 attend Central Lakes College, and then we have Northwest Technical College in Bemidji as well, and I look forward to serving on the committee. I have been an adjunct professor at BSU in the business department, and looking forward to this.
Hi, I'm Ron Latz. I represent Senate District 44, which is St. Louis Park, Hopkins, and most of Golden Valley, first ring suburbs of Minneapolis. This is my second term in the Senate. I was in the House for 4 years before that. I've been on the Higher Ed Committee in both bodies continuously since I started service in the legislature. I do not have any higher education institutions physically located in my district. I think one of the few in the legislature, which makes me a true freelancer. But I do have a lot of students and faculty from all of the institutions in the metro area, particularly from the U and some of the technical schools nearby.
Thanks.
I'm Senator Kathy Sharon. I'm Senate District 23, which is
Excuse me, Senator. Can you just turn one of those towards you since you
turn
missing
my head to you?
Since you got a yeah, there
since
we go.
Otherwise
thanks.
You and the district is you would recognize because it's where Mankato, part of Blue Earth County, all of Nicola County, St. Peter, and Sibley County. I have five institutions of higher education that reflect the Minsky system, two-year and four-year, as well as two private colleges and a for-profit college in my district. Of course, there are the other certificate programs that we all have. Most importantly, though, I have many, many families that want their children to be able to have access to higher education and to have options to quality education at an affordable price.
Thank you. We'll go over here to Senator Brown.
Yes, Dave Brown, Senate District 16, which includes all or parts of Mille Lacs County, Sherburne, Benton, and Morrison. I do not have any institutions of higher education within my district, but several surrounding my district. And as Senator Latz said, I look forward to having that freedom to serve on this committee. So look forward to it.
I'm Senator John Peterson. I serve Senate District 15, which includes couple townships, but if they have the address of St. Cloud, Rockville, St. Augusta, or Waite Park as the district that I serve, you've all heard of St. Cloud State being the second largest university in this state is in my district, along with the St. Cloud Technical College. And looking forward to serving on this committee and certainly grateful to serve the opportunity to serve our constituents here from Senate District 15.
Hi, I'm Senator Tom Saxog from Senate District 3. That goes from the northwest angle all the way down to Mille Lacs Lake, about 8,000 square miles. The two higher education institutions, actually three that are in my district, are Rainy River Community College in International Falls and Itasca Community College in Grand Rapids, along with a branch of the University of Minnesota, which is also in Grand Rapids.
Rod Skoy from Senate District 2 in North Central Northwestern Minnesota. Happy to be back on higher ed again after a four-year absence. Looking forward to working with you all as we work to afford Minnesotans opportunity to improve themselves through higher education.
I'm Claire Roebling. I represent Senate District 35, which is the majority of Scott County, Shakopee, Prior Lake, Savage, Alco, Newmarket, and Jordan area. And I was the lead Republican on the higher ed committee in recent years. And so I have quite an interest in it, although I have no Minsku campuses either. I have one for-profit school in Shakopee. And yet I have a very highly educated district and people who are very, very interested in education. And, of course, we might be looking more at online education because we don't have any facilities right nearby. Normandale is our closest campus, and Hennepin Technical College in Eden Prairie. But we certainly have to look at options and how we're going to serve this array of people seeking education and job opportunities in areas that may not have even existed before. And so I think we have a great challenge before us as we try and meet those goals.
Thanks.
Hello, everybody. I'm Sandy Pappas from St. Paul, and I love all our higher ed institutions. I was formerly the chair of the committee. I'm the lead Democrat now. And education is the key to our future, and having a more educated population is going to be very, very important for Minnesota in the next 20 years. We need to up the ante and get more people credentialed. It's going to be real important.
Thank you very much. And I will say that Senator Pappas and Senator Roebling are probably our most knowledgeable on the committee, so we will look to them for help. So thank you very much, and thanks to for everybody for serving on the committee. What's that? You're really knowledgeable, but on something else. Yep, and I'm sorry, I did forget to. And our Senate counsel is John Fuller. Well, we introduced everybody, and I'm sorry, I apologize, I forgot to. I overlooked it. I was so excited about everybody else. So. Not forgetting somebody. Well, today I think what we've got planned is an overview presentation from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and we have with us today, if we could just have you come to the table. I understand there's a handout in our bag or in our folders also, but we have Barb Schlafer, Mark Michikanis, and Tricia Grimes. So thank you so much for coming in today. I think that some overviews are important, particularly with the amount of new folks we have in the legislature this year. So I really appreciate you coming in. So whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Barb Schlafer. I'm the acting director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. With me are Mark Michikanis. He's the director of finance and research, and Tricia Grimes, policy analyst, also with the Office of Higher Education. We're honored to be the very first item on your agenda for 2011. And so we were asked to come give an overview of the agency. With your permission, we'll go ahead and get right to it. The Office of Higher Education became a cabinet agency in 2003. Prior to this, it was the Higher Education Services Office, and it was an independent board that named its director. At the time, the governor and the legislature sought an independent administrative-level voice for higher education that was not connected to any system or institution. Our mission is to advance the promise of higher education to all Minnesotans and to provide the critical information needed to make informed higher education decisions. We serve students across the state in both public and private institutions. We regulate more than 150 private institutions, of which about 100 are participating in state financial aid programs. The Office of Higher Education serves students in a whole variety of ways. We'll go into each of these in more detail in a moment, but first, financial aid. By far the largest portion of our state appropriation goes directly to students in the form of grants, scholarships, work study, and other aid. Second, consumer protection. Third, college access and information. And finally, through data and analysis, we're able to provide an independent statewide look at all of higher education. Our agency has 65 employees, of which only 24 are state-funded. And with that, Mark's going to talk a little bit about some of our major programs.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. I'm going to go through the next 10 or 11 slides, but please stop me if you have any questions along the way. But this is an overview, so we're trying to give you kind of a broad scope of the agency and the programs at this point. And I'm sure during the session, and especially in budget conversations, we can get in more detail as well. So what you have in front of you is just kind of – this is the pie of higher ed, if you will, on the spending side. We've taken fiscal 11 from the Department of Management and Budget's November forecast, and this simply shows you where the money goes out of the budget that you will be discussing over the next few months here. Roughly 44% of about $1.359 billion is the number that's in the total, goes to the MinSCU system. Roughly 45% goes to University of Minnesota. The remaining 11% roughly goes to our office, except for a small amount that goes to the Mayo Medical School, which is not shown on here because it's such a small amount. But about 11% goes to our office. 93% of that goes out in financial aid in a variety of programs, which I'll get into some of the major ones in a few minutes here. So that's the bulk of the money. 2% of that total goes to running the agency on the general fund side. Student aid in Minnesota is decentralized. A lot of the work goes on at the campus levels. So we do a lot of training of those financial aid officers, but there's an awful lot of work that goes on at the campus level in order to, in some ways, minimize the work that we do at the state agency. And then the remaining 5% is other programs, the largest of which is the Minitex MinLink program that's operated over at the University of Minnesota, but the appropriation goes through your committee to our agency and then to that program. So you'll hear more about that program later on as well. Let me kind of go into some of the broader detail than on the various programs. The largest program we operate is simply referred to as the Minnesota State Grant Program. In fiscal 11, we're projecting to spend about $119 million. There's a table later on that shows you a bit of history of that, and I can describe that for as well. The second large program that we operate is our supplemental loan program. It's referred to as a self-loan program. A few key points. This is all funded through loans that we give to the students. They repay them. There is no general fund money involved in this at all. It's a very successful program. And then there's an array of smaller programs that sum up to about $29 million, the largest of which is a work-study program. This is institution-based. We send money out to institutions that is used for work-study jobs at the institutions. The next largest program is our post-secondary child care program of roughly $7 million a year. This is for use for child care on the campuses for students that need that particular service. We operate a tuition reciprocity program with surrounding states, both North and South Dakota, Wisconsin, a few schools in Iowa, not the whole state, but just a few schools. And the reciprocity program has been in place for a number of decades, actually. And the number you see there, the $4 million, is essentially kind of an evening up as students flow between the states. And the spending on this program is for a payment that we make to North Dakota. A lot more of our students from Minnesota end up in North Dakota than come here for some reason, because there's just a much smaller population in Minnesota, obviously, and they have some excellent schools up there. So this program essentially evens up the spending that we make on their students and our students and trying to even things up. We also have a very large program with Wisconsin, but that is much more directly related to operations at the University of Minnesota. And again, when we get to, I think, some budget conversations, we can get into more detail about the flows of funds if that satisfies the chair. We have an ACHIE program. This has been in place for about 3 years. Spends about $764,000, although there is some federal money involved that would increase that up to $1.2 million for fiscal 11. We operate a 529 college savings plan. 529 is simply the reference to the IRS code, and this gives tax benefits to parents or other contributors to a savings plan for students. The number you see there, the $328,000, is really a small amount of money that we use for a matching program plan for low-income people. There's actually somewhere in the range of $700 million of total assets in these plans. It's managed by TIA CREF, but we actually do a contract with them. So the real savings involved here is much, much larger than the number that you see on this chart. And then finally, a GI Bill was passed a few years ago in the legislature. It's, the funding actually is not in this committee. It's in the Vets Committee. But since we're the scholarship people for higher education, we do the administration for them. They simply contract with us to do the work. So it's on the list for your consideration. If I can move on then and give you just a little bit more on the...
Excuse me.
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chair, Ms. Connors, can you repeat what you said about North Dakota?
North Dakota.
I think I misunderstood.
Madam Chair, or Senator Tomasoni, there is more students that leave Minnesota, go to school in North Dakota than come from North Dakota. And, you know, obviously because they're just a smaller state, there's fewer high school kids. They leave Minnesota, go to North Dakota.
So we have more students from Minnesota that go to North Dakota schools than North Dakota sends to Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, that's correct. That's correct.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Tomasoni, they have two land-grant universities right on the border that draw a lot from the northern part.
But I don't think he said that on Senator the first Tomasoni. Try. So I was just trying to get him to clarify.
That's
I thought I heard something different.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, if that's not what I said, that's what I meant. So.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the members, if I can move on. This on the state grant itself, we have three or four slides here because it is such an important program. But again, this is an overview, so there's a lot more detail that underlines this program. But simply on eligibility, in order to receive a grant, you have to be a Minnesota resident. So students that come to Minnesota from other states, including North Dakota, do not qualify for state grants. But they're available to any Minnesota institution, public or private. You have to show satisfactory progress from year to year if you're going to continue to receive a grant from year to year as you attend an institution. You have to demonstrate financial need. So it is targeted to low and middle income families. And you do have to complete what's referred to as a FAFSA or a free application for federal student aid. If any of you have college students, I'm sure you've worked through the drudgery of filling out FAFSAs. And there's a number of other smaller eligibility requirements. Each of these eligibility requirements is something that you consider as policy matters through the course of time. But there's a number of other smaller, minor ones as well. Just a bit of background and history on the program. Created in 67, significant modification back in the early 80s. I think this is actually a very important fact. It demonstrates that the program is successful. Because it has longevity. It seems to work for the people that it's supposed to serve. While there's always tweaks to the parameters from year to year, the fact is that programs can come and go in the legislature, but this has been one that's been around for quite a long time. As I mentioned, it's a need-based grant. It really is about choice. In fact, there's a little purpose statement in the statute that talks about the state grant that was adopted by the legislature in the early 80s. The choice is one of the fundamental premises of the program. Students go to the institutions that best fit their needs, whether it's public or private, for-profit, non-profit. It's up to them to make that determination, what best fits my needs as an individual for the education that I'm looking for. And then as a kind of an underlying philosophy, we refer to it as shared responsibility, but the idea is that there's three parties in this process. There's a student, the person getting the benefit of the investment, there's the family, and then there is a third party, the taxpayer. So let me kind of move to this chart. In a bit of an overview, I can kind of describe the way the state grant works. What you have on the chart along the bottom is simply a measure of family's income, adjusted gross income. And then on the y-axis, if you will, the recognized price of attendance. Now, that recognized price is something that you establish as a policy body. It's comprised of two parts, tuition and fees, and then a living and miscellaneous expense. And you set a cap for tuition and fees and also an LME, it's referred to, level as well. The current tuition cap is $10,488. The current level of the LME is $7,000. So the idea is you add those two numbers together to come up with a recognized price. Now, obviously, in certain institutions, the price that's actually charged is higher than that. University of Minnesota is higher than the cap. And again, the cap is a four-year cap, by the way. Most of the private institutions in the state are above that. But you establish this price as for the purposes of the program. So the combination of the two is roughly a little bit more than $17,000. But we've just showed the $16,000 here because this is something in the range of a four-year Minsky institution. Then kind of simply working through the colors, if I may, the orange part that's constant across all incomes, is the student share. And the idea here is that a student is the main recipient of the investment in their education, so they should pay the first dollar towards the cost of it or price of attendance. And this is set as a percentage. So the current percentage is 48%, 48.2% to be exact. And the idea is that depending on where you go attend college, if you attend a more expensive college, you are expected to pay a higher share or higher amount based on that percentage. So obviously the 48% at a private college like St. Thomas, you know, or Carleton would be much higher than a 48% at a 2 or 4 year Minsky institution. But again, this is every student pays the same percentage, regardless if they're in the lowest income family or the highest income family. The second block, if you will, then is kind of the second partner as it comes into play is the blue share. This is the family share. And again, this is based on income and based on what's called the needs analysis as determined by the information you fill in the FAFSA. And you can see that from incomes in the mid-30s up until about the mid-70s, the idea is that families' obligation increases. As their income increases, their obligation increases. Until you get to the recognized, the cap or the recognized price, then the family share and the student share is expected to pay for all of that cost of attendance. So there's no taxpayer involvement at that point at all. So then the taxpayer share are the other two green shaded areas. And the light green shaded area is the federal share. That's reflected in the Pell Grant. And then the darker part is the state grant. So it fills in. The state grant program is interesting, I think, unique in some ways. It's that it's so well integrated between state funding and federal funding. There's lots of programs that are in state government that that integration doesn't exist at all, and there are other ones that it does exist fairly well. But this is one of those where it exists fairly well. So the idea is that share the price of attendance between student, family, the federal government on the Pell side, and the state government on the state side. Again, Madam Chair, I understand there's a lot of detail here, and as we kind of revisit this, I think, through the course of the session, there may be other questions that I can respond to, or we can respond to as a team, and flesh out some of the details. I'll give you one example. If you look at the blue blocks, if you will, if you actually made a line out of that from the middle income, I'm sorry, the lowest point to the highest point, that's essentially a tax rate on families. It's an extremely steep tax rate once you look at the numbers. And we can actually have a conversation about that as we bring that detail to bear. There's about 80,000 students in the state that receive a state grant, so it's important to a great number of students and families. The average grant is in the range of eight.
Mr. Canis, do you know the breakdown of those 80,000? What sectors of the higher ed, you know, U of M, Minsky, four-year colleges? I mean, do you know the breakdown of where those are going?
Madam Chair, we can slice and dice it in numerous ways, by sector, by income, absolutely.
Okay, because I'd be interested in where, out of those 80,000 students, where that's, is it going to 2 years, is it going to 4 years, is it going to U of M schools, Minsky schools? So if you have that information, yes, that'd be wonderful.
We'll Thank provide you. It for the committee.
Thank you.
Yes. And we're sort, Madam Chair, and members, we attempt to be the best source for not just that kind of information, but anything on higher ed that's across all sectors. As Barb mentioned, that's kind of our role. But anyway, there's about 80,000 students a year. The average grant is about $1,800. Again, that kind of fluctuates from year to year. I mentioned the application process is well coordinated with a federal Pell Grant. In fact, 70% of the recipients also receive a Pell Grant, so there's a good connection there. And then finally, about 85% of the state grant dollars are awarded to students from families with incomes below $50,000. If I can move on to the next chart, then this is simply a chart of state grant spending going back the last 10 years. And just a couple of points to make about this. One is that for the most part, the spending has increased over this time period simply because more students are in school. some of the parameters have changed. The recognized price has gone up in some cases, or LME has gone up in some cases, or the legislature has made other policy changes, and essentially to get more grant money out to students to ease some of the cost burdens that they face. I just want to talk a bit about the last 2 years, 2010 and 2011, the projected numbers, because they stand out so much. This is the increase in spending between 2009 and 2010, going from 144 to 168, was essentially due to the numbers right next to it. A lot more kids showed up in school because of the recession. I think it's as straight up as that. Many two-year institutions on the Minsky side, but across the board, there was just because, you know, students couldn't find jobs, people were returning back to school who had lost jobs, all a variety of reasons, enrollments were up tremendously across the state. That created quite a problem for us. I mean, we have gotten better at making projections of this program over the last 5 or 6 years. We work closely with the Department of Management and Budget to try and make sure that this is connected to some of their revenue forecasts on the income side. This is an income-driven program, so we make the connection back to the revenue forecast. We work well with the institutions to get their enrollment forecast, but even they get surprises too. Whether it's the publics or the private institutions, they can be surprised about not only who shows up, but who doesn't show up, who they expected. And we try to work closely with them, too, on tuition increases, because that tends to drive the price as well. But there was a big surprise last year. So we made the decision after consultation with policymakers, because this is a two-year appropriation. The current law allows us to move monies between fiscal years. So the decision we had to make is, students showed up last year. Do we pay all the grant amounts that we made a promise to? I mean, students made decisions in that fall to go to college based on what the grants were going to be. Do we make all those full grants, or do we ration the money and try and create move some of it to the second year of the biennium? So we had this balancing act, if you will. The decision was to move all the money into the first year. So this is why you see the $168 million, that big number there, for fiscal 10. It's a fixed appropriation between the 2 years, and there was simply no money, of course, last year to add to the program. So we ended up the current school year rationing the state grant to families. This is why you see the large drop in the number of recipients from 103,000 to 82,000, and this is why you see the large drop in spending from 168,000 to 119,000. Just for purposes of the conversation, Madam Chair and members, the base funding that you'll see in the budget is about $144 million. One last point is that there is some minor federal money we get from a couple federal programs, a little bit in excess of $1 million, that also we essentially put into this pot and use to pay state grants to students.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are the number of students that are projected to also be enrolled in the programs, are they still up there then? As high as they were in 2010?
Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey, the number you see in front of you is a projection for this year. I think our projections for the 12 and 13 fiscal year are flat. Part of the problem you're going to have to wrestle with is that that's going to drive spending above the current base appropriation. So I'm not sure that it's going to be at 100. It's not going to be at 103,000. It's going to be lower than that, but probably above the 82,000. And again, we've got this balancing between where we spent money this biennium and where you're going into the next biennium. So we're going to come to you with recommendations of some sort that deal. You have actually two problems on your hands. You have a base funding, and you have projected spending above that base funding. And then that's before you deal with the $6.2 billion. So you got kind of a two-part problem you're going to have to deal with.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Mr. Misakonis, to follow up on Senator Gimsey's question, in terms of enrollment at the institutions, did you recognize any fall off in enrollment from those who no longer were able to get grants because of the funding shortage? We had 103,000 people got grants in 2010, and obviously a lot less in 2011. Were there people who couldn't go to college as a result? Was there any way to determine whether their inability to get grant funding caused them to not enroll?
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, let me take your second question first. No, we don't know if lower money available actually created a situation for a student where they could not enroll. We're not sure about that. As far as the enrollments themselves, we're kind of holding them flat, so no declines. So to the extent, for instance, the economy starts to grow and students can find jobs and don't attend, that's not something at this point we're taking into account, because we're taking their last actual enrollment figures, keeping that flat. Now, we just have enrollment. We kind of use that as a proxy for recipients, because it's we have to estimate that through a simulation process of recipients. But just on the enrollment side, they increased, of course, 2 years ago, and we're holding them kind of flat for our projection purposes.
Senator Rowling, did you have a question? Or?
Oh, Madam Chair, I was just going to ask. So when you were reducing the benefit, did you take it off of the income level? I mean, were you dropping income eligibility so that the people, the families with the highest incomes, were the first to lose their financial aid, or did you spread it across a wider range? How did you do it?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, we use the rationing process. There actually is a rationing process in law, and there's two parts to it. One, we're supposed to increase the student share by an amount and then adjust the family contribution by an amount. We're supposed to do it in roughly equal dollars. So the families pay roughly a bit more and the students pay a bit more. The student share was 46%, and went to 48.2% because of the rationing.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the other half of the rationing did work in that way, such that the grant decreased more the higher the family's income was within that $30,000 to $70,000 range.
Madam Chair, I think the question might be, did 20,000 people lose eligibility as a result? Is that sort of what you're asking? Because the answer is really that students who had smaller grants did drop off. There was a number. There were a number of them. I don't know how many exactly. We can get you that number. But there were some that definitely dropped off in terms of when the eligibility criteria were adjusted to reduce demand on the program.
Correct.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, if I can move on and to the loan program, our self-loan program. I just have one chart on this to give you a summary. Again, this is one that's been around for quite a while. It's 1983. It's meant to be a supplemental program. Typically, students borrow first from the federal government and then may come to us or may go to another private vendor, if you will. But it was meant to be supplemental. Roughly, there's about more than 20,000 students that borrow from us every year. And these can be students both within the state. They do not have to be residents in Minnesota to borrow if they attend a college in Minnesota. Likewise, you can be a Minnesota resident and attend a school outside the state, and as long as you have an agreement with us, Marquette, for instance, you can borrow through the self-loan program as well. The current school year, this year, we're anticipating providing about $90 million of loan proceeds to students. This is down quite a bit from last year. It was more in the range of $125 to $130 million for a number of reasons. Some have to do with some federal law changes on disclosure. As I mentioned earlier, there's no general fund appropriation. The way we fund this is by issuing tax-exempt or taxable bonds. We just completed a sale in December of $55 million. Very successful. We deal a lot with the rating agencies, bond underwriters, and the like. And they like the program structure very much. We got a AA rating, which is, I think, a bit rare. We're very unique in the country the way this program is structured. It's very successful. We have actually two kinds of programs we offer students, two loan structures. One is fixed, and that's brand new, last fall. 7.25% is the interest rate that we're charging students. We did this because we tried to respond, quote, to the market. A lot of students are a bit concerned about variable rate loans, not just students, families, parents, everybody's. They're concerned about loans where their interest rate can change. So we respond to that. We went with a fixed rate program, and to date it's been fairly successful. And we came out with it back in November, so that was before the big push in January given the terms of school. So we'll see at the end of January just what's going on with the program. But again, we issued $55 million in bonds to support that. Our other program, the one that's been in place for a long time, is a variable rate program. The current interest rate on that is 3.8%. Extremely cheap money for students. To the extent they have to borrow, which no one wants to do, obviously, but to the extent that we can help them on this side, it's a good rate. It's been low for quite a while, but all interest rates are low across the board. So those are the two products that we have. You see there's an annual maximum of $10,000 per year for four-year programs. But again, the maximum loan limits are something you establish under law. They differ between four-year programs and two-year programs. There's cumulative limitations as well. You can only borrow so much out of the program over the course of your time in school. And then one final point is the default rate. This has been in the press quite a bit lately at the national level, default rates. But if you look at the loans that we've issued cumulative over the last 20 years, going back to 1990, you take all those loans, the initial default rate is only 4.6%. That means someone entered into default, but we have a number of collection mechanisms. There's a co-signer on the loan, which is something very important. So the net default rate is less than 2%. So it's on that kind of metric, it's a very successful program as well.
Mr. Misukanis. Oh, Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Misukanis, what is the margin after the last bond sale? What are we paying for that money versus the 7.25 or the 3.8?
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, on the variable rate, we actually get a little more detail tied into the LIBOR, three-month LIBOR, which is, I think, at 30 basis points. So it's that plus a margin that we add of roughly, 3.5% to cover a cost of a servicer and things like that. So it's the actual interest rate, the cost of money is pretty cheap, and the difference is simply all the other administrative costs. On the interest rate on the loan, on the bonds that we just issued, the true interest cost is something under 5%, 4.7 or something like that. So,
Mr. Misukanis, I was also wondering, you said we were unique in this program or how we structured it. What other states have this kind of state program, state loan program? Do you know?
I have Tricia Grimes.
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. There are 14 other states that have state loan programs, but most of them are rather small and specialized. Many of them are for a particular occupation. Ours is the one in Texas, a new one in New York, and the one in New Jersey are the biggest four of among states that have state loan programs. But only 15 states have any kind of a state loan program.
And maybe someone could address, Mr. and Mr. Canis, you explained the default rate a little bit, but you were quoting numbers that went back to the beginning of the program. How about the last few years? Is it similar to what we've seen in other student loan programs?
Madam Chair, it may be best to get you the chart of that.
Okay.
As we went through this bond sale, believe me, we had to provide that detail, and let's say to the rating agencies, so we can give you history. And part of it, we have to be a little, we're always a little concerned about when you use the term default rate, what you mean. I mean, the federal government looks at two-year default rates, they're going to a three-year default rate. We're concerned about over the lifetime of a loan because, you know, there may well be a default that is repaired later in a person's life.
But my understanding is you were talking the 4.6 was over the entire life of the program, not loans. It was like since 19—correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding since 1983, you said that was kind of the average, or—
Madam Chair, it's since 1990, so go back 20 years.
Okay.
And if you take the accumulated sum of all the loans issued for that 20-year period— and look at the defaults over that. So this is a pretty inclusive figure. Now, I should say that we have seen defaults trickle up a bit because of the economy. You'd expect it.
Okay.
And we'll get you the numbers about how those have changed over the last couple of years as well.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair and members, and if I'll move on to one last chart, and then Tricia Grimes will take on over some of the presentation. Just on the consumer protection side of the agency, as Ms. Schlafer mentioned, there's a number of institutions that we do regulate in the state. It's ongoing. It's all private, not-for-profit, and for-profit schools in the state are regulated, as well as public institutions that are not located in Minnesota but actually offer services here. This is actually a changing area. The federal government is requiring institutions to register in the states that they operate in. So if the University of Maryland is doing online learning in Minnesota, they now have to register with us because of certain changes at the federal level. But I want to be real clear about what I mean by regulation. Institutions are required to submit their financial statements to us annually. We review those. We actually go through a process every 5 years of looking at catalogs and degrees of faculty to make sure that things are lined up. So I would characterize it as a bit of a light touch regulation, if you will. Just a second bullet on this chart then. We approve all programs and degrees before anybody can offer a new program. They submit the requirements to us, and we actually use external consultants or experts to help us evaluate programs. We don't have that in-house. We do not have the capacity to evaluate every new program that's offered in the state. But we use external consultants to help us work through that. Certainly when students have trouble recovering fees, if there is a difference in something that they've paid that they thought was unfair, the school may have been unlicensed or not registered, we help students constantly recovering fees. If we get a complaint, we'll deal with the school. Sometimes it's just a matter of a conversation. Oh, there's been a misunderstanding. We work things out. Very, very rarely have we ever had to pursue schools in any kind of aggressive manner with the schools. There's really a balance, I think, in the state. Minnesota schools, private schools, operate very effectively and very well. I mean, they're all good institutions. And so I think our regulatory aspect is pretty balanced with regard to that. We have not had any kind of problems with schools misbehaving in any kind of way. As I mentioned, we get their financial statements every year, and we look at, we want to make sure they're financially viable, they can operate and actually offer services to students. So we look at those statements. And then finally, as part of the consumer protection, but even broader, we conduct routine audits of all the schools, private and public in the state, to make sure that the dollars you appropriate are being used in the way that you intended them to be used. So with that, Madam Chair and members, if there's no questions, I turn it over to Tricia.
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Our agency has a number of activities related to college access and information in an effort to increase college readiness and participation. The office plays a role in providing information and support to some students in K-12. We do this through several programs. First, the Get Ready program has operated in Minnesota since 1996 and is primarily supported by a federal Gear Up grant. We have staff in 11 schools and provide resources to schools statewide. Second, the Intervention for College Attendance program is a competitive grant program that awards grants to organizations across the state that are working with groups of students, generally 15 to 300 students, depending on the program, from groups that are traditionally underrepresented in higher education. And the activities help the students prepare for college and understand the process of applying for admission and financial aid. Third, the Office of Higher Education administers a new federal grant designed for college access and outreach called the Federal College Access Challenge Grant. And finally, the agency provides financial aid training, presentation to parents, publications, and other materials. A little bit more about the Get Ready program. We have staff in 11 schools serving students in grades 4 through 12. And what the staff do is work through a curriculum with the students that college is possible, that it can make a difference in their ability to support themselves in the future and to learn and do the kinds of things they want to do. So that they take things like math and reading seriously enough that they can take the right classes in middle school and high school and be prepared to go to college. We serve 6,300 low-income and underrepresented students directly with this kind of service, with academic advising, tutoring, college visits, and summer academic programming. And then we serve an additional 2,600 students across the state with additional resources, especially publications and curriculum requested by their teachers. We also do outreach. We provide training to more than 500 school counselors and financial aid staff, fulfill requests from 900 schools for materials, and fulfill requests for more than 50 presentations each year to community groups and parents and students. We have a website called getreadyforcollege.org that's specifically targeted to students and parents to help them find the information they need. And then you can see the covers of three of our publications, and all of these publications are available either by mail or online. Then another set of activities the agency does have to do with higher education data analysis. We like to think that the Office of Higher Education is where people go for comprehensive Minnesota data relating to higher education. We maintain the state's enrollment database for public and private higher education institutions. We gather and analyze information on trends nationally, internationally, and in Minnesota. And we produce many reports. And what follows are a few slides showing some of the kinds of data we collect. But we know that these are just a few samples, the tip of the iceberg. If you have questions about higher education in Minnesota, chances are we can answer them for you. This slide has to do with undergraduate enrollment in Minnesota and how it's been changing over the last 10 years. It's what they call headcount enrollment. We consistently take a measure in the fall and just count the number of people that are enrolled. And you can see that the largest number of students are enrolled at public, community, and technical colleges in the MINSCU system. Then the state universities, University of Minnesota, and private colleges, each of those sectors have between 40 and 60,000 students. And their enrollment has been increasing moderately over the last 10 years. And then the private career schools have enrollment that has been increasing substantially over the last 10 years. And just one little word about the private career online schools. Those are basically Capella University and Walden University, which are headquartered in Minnesota, and the University of Phoenix. And these schools do serve this number of undergraduates. They also serve a much larger number of graduate students.
Excuse me, there's a couple of questions. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Grimes. On the undergraduate enrollment headcount, do you have this kind of graph also on how many graduates each one of these different types of schools have every year and how that ties into this?
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, and in fact, in a couple of slides, we will have some information about graduation rates in particular. And we also have information about numbers of degrees produced and that kind of thing. But some of that is something we would have to provide to you in future.
Thank you. I'll wait.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Grimes, on the same undergraduate enrollment graph, we're going to get some more information on that, too. But can you give us any more insight to trends that we're seeing here that this shows us?
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, perhaps we could do that at a future hearing. We have information on age, gender, race, ethnicity, full-time, part-time enrollment, income, a whole set of things like that, and perhaps we could provide more of that information at a future hearing.
We will certainly consider that. That would be interesting to know. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Will you also, I don't know, suppose you have it here, would you also include, if along with the graduation rates, do you follow up on your graduates to determine if they're employed in the fields in which they've been educated? Are they able to find employment there?
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Senator, the federal government requires some reporting from institutions on the extent to which graduates are employed in fields related to what they studied. More information, frankly, is required of students enrolled in programs that are more directly occupational than are required for liberal arts programs, for example. But there is some information about that, and we can try to provide it to you.
Since I have a liberal arts
degree. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to back up just a couple of slides to number 18 and the Get Ready program. I see that, and you told us that we have staff in 11 schools, grades 4 through 12. Can you tell us where those schools are and then the number of staff that are in those 11 schools? Is that possible?
Just Madam Chair and Senator, the 11 schools that we have staff in, and these are basically federally funded staff, are low-income serving schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then when schools in other parts of the state want information and curriculum, we provide them with training and curriculum and publications to help them do that kind of curriculum in other parts of the state.
Any more questions?
Get to the right slide here. This one is mine.
Yeah, Madam Chair, let me just take this one. This, with the slide you have in front of you, is simply shows the spending for higher education. Again, this is the amount that this committee deals with. As a share of total state general fund spending going back into the 60s, simply gives you some context of what's been changing from a budget perspective. Obviously, at one point, well back in the late 60s, higher education was almost 18% of the state general fund budget. Today, it's somewhere in the range of 8.5%. The dramatic change in this chart occurred in the late 80s, where it's been a shift downwards over that period of time. This is not unusual compared to other states. Other states, the same fact exists, and it exists for lots of reasons. In some cases, it may be fewer students. It may be that there's simply been a shift in priorities by state government to K-12, public safety, health and human services, issues like that. So, but again, this gives you some sense of what's been going on with the amount of money that you have jurisdiction over in this budget.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Misakonis, on this graph, didn't the state have a goal or some kind of part of their statute where they were going to pay 70% of the cost of education at a public school? And I know that we're down under 50% now. I don't know exactly what it is, but can you kind of walk me through on this graph how we were doing with that percentage, or maybe that's something for another day also?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, actually in statute, I think it's 67% or 66% of the sum of tuition and state aid. So when you add those two numbers together, it's the goal. It's not a hard.
It's a goal.
It's
yeah.
a goal for state funding to be about 2/3 of that amount of money. You're right. It's under 50%. I'm sure the Minsk University could tell you what the exact levels are. It's hard for me right now to tell you how that changed over time in relationship to this graph. My guess is it could have been a declining share of the general fund, but still had met that 2/3 mm-hmm. at some point, or at least a number higher than 50%, that's for sure.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, excuse me, one other question. Senator Latz.
Also, if now or some other time, could you provide us with comparable figures for percentage or of actual dollar amounts adjusted for inflation so we can actually see the decline in the actual appropriations to the different higher education sectors?
Senator Skoy.
Yeah, thank you. And that brought a thought to my mind. You know, part of the problem that's going on with debt that the students are incurring as they graduate is this 46, now 48% student share is primarily what they have to borrow. And as the state has not been filling up its base share at the public institution, what they have to pay is going up, and that's the debt load. Is that a fair analysis, Mr.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, let me suggest this. Actually, we talk an awful lot about this in our agency, about that price that's established. And we did an extensive study of the state grant program a couple years ago and how it hasn't kept up with tuition changes or inflation, things like that. And even, for instance, the LME at $7,000, we've done some estimates lately based on figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that suggest that students are really spending about $12,000. So it's not just a private tuition issue or the University of Minnesota tuition issue. It's both. And that's kind of hidden up there because it's above that parameter that you establish here. All that lends itself to borrowing as well. So everything is a source of borrowing for students.
Well, Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, back to Senator Skoy's original question about this chart and the 2/3, 1/3. It would be possible to superimpose on this chart the line that he's talking about, correct? So you could actually see if back in 1967, if it was 95% state funding as opposed to two-thirds, or if it's half, 50% now. What I'm thinking of is that is there some way you can actually correlate the percentage of state funding and compare it with the state share versus the student share? And I think this chart here could be used to actually indicate where we've gone and what's happened.
I see the decline. So
I don't know if you could possibly do that, but maybe yeah, that's for another hearing.
Madam Chair and Senator Thomas-Tony, I'm not sure we can get back to 67 with all those components of the data, but we'll put together what we can. And
well, you have it here.
But just as only part of it, though.
So. Yeah, I know, but I would think you could just superimpose the over the top of this and be able to show it.
Senator Peterson, did you have a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, if we're going to continue down this line of comparison, I think it's also important to note what the number of enrollment was in 1967, as well as the number of institutions. If you could please provide that at the same time. Thank you.
Well, you guys have quite a few assignments. if you'd like to proceed now.
Madam Chair, we appreciate the interest. When we put together this presentation, we didn't want to overwhelm you with statistics, and it's nice to be asked. I'm going to talk about the slide on tuition and fees over the last 10 years. Now, this is the published tuition and fees, the sticker price, if you will. And in a couple more slides, I'll be talking a little bit more about the fact that in actuality, 78% of Minnesota students, at least those who attend full-time, get some sort of grant or scholarship to help pay their tuition and fees. And so there is a difference between sort of the posted price, the published price, and the net price. But looking at this, you can see tuition in the various sectors and how it has been increasing over the last 10 years. And I just might note the line here that says public four-year institutions. That's an average of the University of Minnesota and the state universities. So I'm going to go over that one kind of quickly because we're going to get back to net price here in a minute. Published tuition and fees currently in 2010-11 at the University of Minnesota for the full attending full-time for the full academic year, $12,288. The state universities, $6,895. At the two-year community and technical colleges, $4,919, and at private nonprofit four-year colleges, $30,400. Then this slide looks at both the published tuition and fees and the net price, and it's a look back because in order to capture all the grants and scholarships, you have to have data that's for years that are complete. So this is for 2008-2009. And I just might point out the public four-year institutions. So in that year, the average tuition and fees were $7,797, but the average net price that students paid was $5,467. And that difference would be from Pell Grants, state grants, and particularly at the University of Minnesota, it would be from institutional scholarships and that come from donated funds they receive. You can see that the biggest difference between the published tuition price and the net price is at the private colleges, the private not-for-profit four-year institutions, and the bulk of that difference is due to institutional scholarships, again, that mostly come from donated funds. And I'm not going to talk about every number on this chart. Just skip over to the public two-year institutions where the average price was $4,600 for tuition and fees, but the average net price was $2,675. And that difference would be nearly all of it would be from federal Pell Grants and state grants.
Madam Chair?
Oh, excuse me. There's a question. Senator Skoy?
Thank you. Ms. Graham, just I don't know if you can speculate on this or not, but as I look at the MinsHU current year tuition of $6,895, and then 2008 there were $46, so it's gone up $2,200. On the, do you have a guess as to what the net cost is changed to? Is that been kind of split between the net and the published, or is it all been in, has the actual gone from $2,675 to $4,675, or can you guess as to what's going on there?
Madam Chair, Senator, There has been some increase in Pell Grants, rather substantial increase in Pell Grants, and so that probably helped students to some extent. On the other hand, the tuition increases that have happened over the last few years have been substantial also. And so it would be kind of hard for me to speculate on that at this point. Moving along, you were asked earlier about graduation rates. Graduation rates, this is the number of full-time, first-time students who started in 2003 and completed a bachelor's degree at the same institution by 2009. And calculating it that way, the graduation rates at the University of Minnesota were 63%. At Minnesota State Universities, 48%, and private colleges and universities were 72%. But the key thing to understand here is this is students who started and finished at the same institution. Many students transfer. They start at one institution and they may continue their education at another institution. Longitudinal studies that track students, regardless of where they attend, pick up about another 10 percentage points that complete a bachelor's degree.
Excuse me, we've got a question. Senator Saxock.
And so, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Grimes, so community colleges then wouldn't be included in here, where you went for two and then you went to...
I have those.
Madam Chair, Senator, we do have other statistics for the number of students who complete community colleges within 3 years for a two-year program. Again, we were trying not to overwhelm you with statistics, but we can provide more information about that in future.
But it isn't included in here.
But those are not included in what you're looking at right here, yes.
And Ms. Grimes, if you attended 2 years at a community college and then went on and got a four-year degree, and your goal was a four-year degree from a four-year university, that would not be in here either?
That's not in these particular statistics, okay. But that contributes to where I said if you track students to wherever they attend, you pick up 10%. Some of those students are those that started at a two-year school and transferred to a four-year school. Others would be students who may have gone the first 2 years at Mankato State and finished up at the University of Wisconsin-River Falls or something like that.
Thank you. Oh, Senator Tomasoni.
So, Madam Chair, we are seeing people that enrolled at the University of Minnesota take 6 years to graduate for a four-year degree because of the fact that they are working too much or they can't afford it or what's going on?
Madam Chair, Senator, there has been a trend over the years for students to take more than 4 years to complete a bachelor's degree. The University of Minnesota has made, as you'll see in the next slide, has made a lot of progress in this regard, and actually their newest statistics are higher than 63%. But this is the data where we could compare across all three sectors. So if you wouldn't mind me heading to the next slide. This shows the six-year graduation rates at four-year institutions at the state universities, the University of Minnesota, and the private colleges. And you can see these are from 1998 in kind of four-year intervals up to 2009. So that you can see that in all three sectors there has been substantial increase in the six-year graduation rate, and the biggest change has occurred at the University of Minnesota.
But Madam Chair. Fabulous.
Senator Tomasoni.
Is there a reason why?
Madam Chair, Senator, you may want to ask that question of the University of Minnesota themselves, but yes, they have made a concerted effort to try to get students to graduate in a more timely manner. They require students to enroll for 13 credits or more if at all possible. They strongly encourage students to take full-time course load each term and so forth, and they have a number of initiatives all designed to improve their graduation rate.
But, Madam Chair,
Senator Tomasoni.
Is it taking 6 years because of the cost, because kids are working? What's the reason it's taking 6 years?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, it's a very good question, and I don't have a short answer to it. Sometimes it takes longer because students double or triple major. Sometimes it is because students are working more. The University of Minnesota actually has information that shows that students will often do something like saying, I'm going to attend half-time this year and work more so that I don't have to borrow so much. But actually, financially, many of them would be money ahead, borrow a little bit more, finish sooner, and get out in the workforce with that bachelor's degree than they would be to attend part-time during the year. But that's a little bit it doesn't sound like that when you're a student thinking about it.
But
Senator Tomasoni.
Give me an answer to my question. Yes. I mean, if you don't know it, that's fine. You can just tell me that. But.
Madam Chair, Senator, basically, I don't know.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Ms. Grimes, Do these graduation figures include students who transferred to the university from somewhere else their junior year?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, these do not.
You have to have started and continued.
This particular statistic is for those who started and finished at the same institution. But those students who started elsewhere and transferred to the university would be part of where we would pick up that additional 10%. Okay.
Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair, Ms. Grimes, is it possible that we're not talking about all these statistics that it didn't take 6 years, but they graduated somewhere between 4 and 6 years? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. This is students who graduated in 4, 5, or 6 years.
Right. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. In Minnesota, there's
a... Excuse me. Senator Sharon.
I'm not certain how to ask this question, but I am interested overall in the way we fund higher education per student for the enrollment, so the early end admissions into the university, and they're funded based on enrollment versus graduation rates is something that's very common that we're starting to talk about, that you drive a certain action or a certain performance at a university or a college based on how money comes in. These graduation rates, the difference of the graduation rate between the private colleges and the state universities is substantial. And so I would be curious just to understand a number of things about that. One, and I don't know if you can provide that, is what the state's interest is in terms of its contribution to the education of students who do not complete an education. What investment have we made that has not borne the outcome of a degree? I'd like to know what we're putting in and not getting an outcome from, if we can get that.
Madam Chair, if I could turn it over to Mr. Mesukanis for a minute.
Madam Chair, just on your first part, Senator Sharon, as you know, we essentially give the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota system lump sum appropriations, and they allocate that money within those two systems as they make those administrative choices. There has been times, even going back to the early 90s, when the legislatures put in place small performance kinds of fundings, but it's been, relatively speaking, very small amounts of money. And they both systems have had to reach certain performance metrics, and they would then obtain the money, you know, after a period of time from the Department of Management and Budget. So you've done that in the past, but it's not been a large amount of money. As to your second question, I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. Other states are doing this. Ohio is starting to move down this path, and other states are paying for graduation as opposed to either the kind of funding you do or even enrollment-based funding. So it seems to be something that's in the air. On your second point, a number of what I would call the national public policy types are getting very concerned about the investment that states are making and with students aren't graduating. You pay for capital. There's an infrastructure you have to put in place. There's operating costs that you expend, and a degree is not obtained. And I don't have a number. I'm not sure I've ever seen one even estimated by the national folks, but there's growing concern about that as well.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Senator, my understanding is that there is some return on investment research which indicates that students who have some college but no degree do, in fact, do somewhat better than those who have no college, but not as well as students who get a degree. In Minnesota, there's a study by Georgetown University that projects that by 2018, 70% of job openings are projected to require post-secondary education. Now, when I say post-secondary education, that does not mean everyone would have to have a bachelor's degree. That means some education after high school, whether it might be short-term training, training in a construction trade, repair kind of training, or an associate degree, bachelor's degree, and graduate degrees. We have lots of different information on this, but we just picked a couple of little pieces. Among 25, 34-year-olds, 48% of the Minnesota population have earned an associate degree or higher, which ranks Minnesota third in the country. But there's still a substantial distance between the 48% we are now and the 70% we're projected to need. For the bachelor's degree level, 35% of Minnesotans in this age group have earned a bachelor's degree or higher, which ranks Minnesota eighth in the country.
Madam Chair and members, I'll take this last chart. This is the final chart of the presentation. And we simply wanted to present to the committee our sense of what the challenges and opportunities, we'll call them opportunities because I think they can be that as well, but there's a huge challenge out there. public policy level for all of higher education across all the sectors, public, private, for-profit or not-for-profit. But again, and I'm sure people at the table or around the room have their different, their own set of what those challenges may be, but we wanted to just to suggest these to you since this is the first meeting. Let me go through here. I think it is important that we improve college readiness in the K-12 system. Of course, that's another committee, the way you're structured here, but higher ed gets what it gets from the K-12 system. And I know there's been conversations, Senator Pappas obviously in the past has been involved in some of these conversations as well. But of the 70% of high school seniors that take the ACT, about a third of them are considered fully college ready. So there is an issue about just college readiness. There are certainly going to be significant demographic changes. We're already in that process. They will continue. And that's both that people retiring, we're going to lose an awful lot of knowledge and skills because of the baby boom retiring at the top end, although that may be changing as well. And at the other side of things, on the incoming groups of students, the demographics are changing. There's many more minority students in the state than there used to be. These are typically families that don't use high post-secondary education the same way historically that others have. So you have those challenges to deal with if the goal is to increase human capital in the state. Improving post-secondary productivity, I think, is on everybody's mind. It simply is the resources aren't going to be there, either public or private, because it's whether it's endowments that are falling off the table because of investments or whether it's monies available from on the public sector. In order to reach the kinds of human capital development you need in the state, I think institutions have to become more productive. We use the term integrate online learning, and I think Senator Roblin, you mentioned that earlier. Online learning is a fascinating thing. Everybody's kind of into it, some because it's a business model, others because they're responding to successful business models. I don't think that the institutions have yet caught on to how to really fully use it, become productive with it. Integrated into their other regular delivery systems. I know a lot of institutions are simply struggling with what do we do with online learning. But certainly you can't deny the technology. It's out there. The next bullet is this notion about re-engaging adult learners effectively. We sometimes take too narrow a definition of what post-secondary education means, especially with technological changes driving business in ways that people simply have to keep relearning their whole life. The idea that you can get to the 70% that Tricia mentioned earlier with the 18-year-old cohorts coming out of high school is simply not possible. We need people with some college that are 40 years old to go back and obtain some more education. So it's really, I know Minsky is doing a great job with this. It's this notion of re-engaging the adult learner. And then finally, student access, choice, and success in light of the limited resources that you have is something that's very important. And all three of those, I think, are extremely important. Access, choice, and success. So,
thank you very much. Are there any questions? I know there's going to be some follow-up on some questions that were asked, so we'll appreciate getting that. And we do appreciate you coming in and starring in our very first committee hearing this year. So, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, I just wanted to make a quick reminder that there is the Science Teaching and Student Services Building Reception and Tour for Legislators tomorrow at the U of M from 3 to 5. And if you need more details, Mr. Otto would be willing to provide those if anybody needs more. We can send this out. I believe the invitations went, but we can make copies and make sure everybody gets one, too. Just a reminder, we're not meeting Wednesday because of the One Minnesota, and we don't meet next Monday because of Martin Luther King Day. So it will be the following Wednesday that we will then pick back up and do an overview with U of M. So thank you very much. Senator Tomasoni. Is the university providing a bus, Mr. Adel?
We are not, but we will pick up parking. We don't have students on campus right now, so there's plenty of parking available. And it's a building right across from the Wiseman Center. Probably suggested parking would be in the Hoffman Union ramp. Right across. The building sits right on the river.
Can you get a bus?
Carpool. Van. Senator Tomasoni is looking for a carpool, if anyone is interested, I think. That's the impression I'm getting.
Talk to me about a ride after.
Well, we can maybe want to talk to Jason, too, and he's willing to see if there's a way we can figure out to get people there, too.
I'd give him a ride, but he's my seatmate, and I spend enough time with him already. So.
Thank you very much, and we will see you, I guess, in a little over a week. Thanks. We're adjourned.